You are listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. This is news team correspondent Gary Leonard, joined in the studio with David Forbes, editor of the Asheville Blade, your local news site focusing on hard-hitting journalism and sharp views from our rapidly changing city. David, thank you as always for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
This is our city council report in which we cover the most recent city council meetings, so you don't have to sit in the chamber for 3 hours. And this actually was a rather short meeting, comparatively so.
The last two have been monsters, basically. Highly technical, highly jargon-filled monstrosities.
So compared to those previous ones, this was a relatively short one. So this meeting took place on September 12th. 2017 at 5 p.m. at the council chamber on the second floor at City Hall. And to just go ahead and dive right into it, David, although it was a short agenda, this was not without issues that came up. So let's go ahead and start in the public hearings, an ordinance to establish provisions for temporary gravel lots in the Central Business District.
Yeah, so this was kind of the big item on the agenda of the evening, as it turned out. It didn't look like a huge amount when it came up, but it tapped into this much larger issue, which is basically is that, you know, Asheville was a major infrastructure issue. Infrastructure kind of languished for many years. And of course, that, you know, hit communities that were redlined, large African-American communities, even harder. So there's some real issues Asheville's infrastructure in the wake of this tourism boom. And parking downtown is one of those. Sometimes it is a regular challenge for downtown workers. It can be a major cut into their paycheck. I've heard issues about it from everyone I know who works downtown as well. And there's this huge influx of tourists, and some locals feel like, hey, we can't go downtown because at any time with a big event's going on, because can't find a freaking parking space. So this is one temporary solution. It's viewed as temporary. Is that the city kind of repeal this restriction, and they agreed to do so 6-0. Councilor Julie Mayfield was absent. But before then, like, they really got an earful from a number of downtown kind of heads of downtown groups and business owners saying, look, this is a serious challenge for us. People from Mass General, the Orange Peel, 10 minutes, which means three people gave up their time. I was given to Karen Ramshaw of Public Interest Project saying, look, like, we have not kept up. Other areas have kept up with parking more. We really need to, like, deal with this in a much better fashion. You know, a lot of people have been pushed outside of city limits. Transit doesn't reach that far. The inadequacy of the transit is a whole other issue, but one very much related to this.
Yep.
And, you know, locals have to go in, and if they're, say, working during an event time, a lot of people can't just shell out, you know, $9 to park in a parking space for an event rate. And so this is, you know, Ramshaw was, you know, definitely didn't hold back. She was very critical, saying, you know, that council had really not kept up. This is a massive issue, and that you were in danger, basically, locals having no, you know, business owners or workers having no purchase into downtown whatsoever. Right. There wasn't a huge amount of disagreement on council about this. As a matter of fact, at one point in the middle, Mayor Esther Mannheimer said, this isn't probably going to be that controversial. But people were still like, no, we need to express this. We don't feel like council's taking this seriously. And they did believe that some cities like Greenville had done a better job of really, like, continuing to keep up with this parking demand. Councilor Gordon Smith mentioned that, you know, a 600-unit parking deck is about to come online, the county Department of Health and Human Services, but that no one at the dais seemed to be clear if that was going to have spaces for the public available, especially on nights and weekends. Mm-hmm. So this continues to be a big challenge. How to do it is a big challenge. And there was even some discussion at the Democratic Socialist Forum last night that, you know, maybe some system of, you know, passes for locals where they would get, you know, local, especially local workers, might get severely reduced rates.
I mean, that happens in other cities.
It does. It does happen in other cities, but it's Asheville, and this makes sense in other cities. It doesn't always mean that people are going to do it here, especially with our government. So,
question in terms of rolling this out, David, the temporary gravel lots, what does the execution of that look like?
Basically, people have the ability to make temporary gravel lots now in Asheville, or use them in downtown.
Yeah.
And a number of spots say that would be helpful until a more permanent solution comes along.
But as of right now, we don't have any clear idea in terms of where those are going to be, like what areas that may be.
Not immediately. The hints from some of the people we talked was that they're going to show up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, one of the people who spoke as a manager of the Orange Peel mentioned, you know, they really could use this pretty shortly and could at least help out with some of the parking challenges during shows and stuff they were having.
So for the listeners out there, be on the lookout for some temporary gravel lots.
Yeah, indeed. But it's also kind of it exemplifies how much larger this debate goes. You know, who has access to the city? Mm-hmm. Does the city try to help locals out, or is it just kind of, you know, throw everyone out there? And also, like, what's the best way to do transit? You know, the point was made, well, look, we should be relying more on the bus. But there was a back and forth of, well, the bus doesn't extend out this far. And the exactly. higher the housing costs exactly. go, the more you drive people out. And the more they have to pay for parking, the more their income goes down. So you kind of have a lot of pressures going on here.
It's interesting that you talked about this issue of, like, yeah, this is more, quote unquote, a low hanging fruit, that there's yeah. not going to be a lot of debate about it. However, I guess maybe like the iceberg issue of, like, the context of, like, this is not an affordable place to live.
Yeah.
You know, parking is a real issue. The transit, you know, commuting into downtown is a massive issue. Where can you park at? I mean, there's just a lot of variables at play. And this almost kind of feels like the tippy top of, like, okay, we'll do this. But, you know, it doesn't answer some of the bigger, I guess, issues that have been prevalent here in Asheville for a really long time.
Yes.
Well, moving on here, David, there was also a public hearing on the proposed limited obligation bond financing for various capital projects and acquisitions. Can you speak to that?
Sure. One of the funnier things about this was its abbreviation, LOBS.
And
as a matter of fact, the presentation that CFO Barbara Whitehorn made on this also dealt with special obligation bonds, or SOBs, as they're known, not SOBs. So
we're talking LOBs and SOBs here.
LOBs and SOBs. So it was interesting because one of the kind of newsworthy things here was that Whitehorn did make this pretty extensive presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the city now has a much better bond rating than it used to. Bond markets feel like Asheville is a reasonably good bet. Asheville doesn't have as much debt compared to a lot of other cities, as this came up actually during the bond referendum. Arguments last year. This is different from that. This is basically the city refinancing existing infrastructure debt mm-hmm. at better rates to save some more money to kind of be more sustainable going forward. Not a huge amount of objection on this front, though certainly the larger issue of city debt is like a very big concern. And interestingly, with different divisions, you know, conservatives opposed the bonds last year because they felt the city shouldn't be taking out the money or raising property taxes
yeah.
at all. And to be fair, the level of property tax hike combined with the county's level, combined with some other things the city raised it for, combined with, say, like the level of salaries for some top city officials, has even raised concerns from some of the left that, like, the money could be allocated a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, you know, some relief should be given to more cash-strapped homeowners, find some way to make this tax, you know, a little more progressive. But conservatives were really critical of the debt. Kind of from the more left-leaning side, you had people who were concerned about, well, where's the money going to go? Which neighborhoods are going to get the infrastructure? Is it going to, you know, favor the more privileged neighborhoods? Is it going to address the issues in more marginalized neighborhoods? If it goes in more marginalized neighborhoods, is it going to be in ways that encourage gentrification or ways that make things easier for people who live there? A lot of big questions with that. This case, though, it was also interesting that there was a big presentation. I've seen a lot of city financial presentations
yeah.
in my time. Probably not good for my sanity.
It's so riveting, though.
Yeah, but a lot of them, you know, you really have to kind of know the jargon.
Heck, yeah.
A lot of them, I've had to go back later and really try to decipher exactly what was going on. This had, you know, had slides, had presentations, mm-hmm. had pictures to it. Definitely a little more transparency being brought to kind of this financial issue than previously. And interesting, I think that is partly a reaction to the criticisms, including ones that that I felt the need to voice, of the lack of transparency around this year's budget.
Right.
That some of the most controversial issues, especially the expansion of policing, mm-hmm. weren't dealt with in a transparent way. They weren't spelled out transparently,
yeah.
and the budget documentation didn't reflect some of the key debates in any way that was remotely easily accessible. It didn't reflect some of the changes at all.
Absolutely.
And so I think you are seeing that public pressure is resulting in kind of, okay, some senior staff are taking the attitude that we do need to try to, like, be a little more transparent over this. We'll see if it sticks,
yeah.
but it certainly, I think it was useful for the public to be able to see, you know, this stuff seems obscure, nuts and bolts, but it really is where a lot of, like, the city's bread and butter kind of
yeah.
relies on, and it's certainly worth more scrutiny. Interestingly, the main comment you had was from conservative developer Chris Peterson, who's a frequent critic of council, says they're spending too much money, going too far in debt, and he asserted the city was about to go bankrupt.
Mm.
And that's a point he commonly makes.
Yeah.
You know, it's I've not really seen much about, you know, how much water that holds outside of that, though there certainly are questions about, you know, the level of property tax burden the city is taking on and who that falls on, and how that falls is certainly a very big question. But, you know, there is a – he was definitely kind of representing that conservative criticism that he didn't feel the city should be taking out near this much debt at all and should do kind of much more limited sort of services.
So a couple of questions that I have for this. Like, I do – this is a positive step in terms of the level of, of transparency that, you know, we haven't really seen in a really long time. And what proved to be, you know, a really some counter – pushback from the community of like, you know, these are real issues that are impacting our neighborhoods and our people and our survival. Yeah. We want to see where this money is being allocated to. Exactly. So yes, great, like positive stuff. But I think for me, one of the things that comes up is the level of like the language that we use, this really bureaucratic language for a lot of people. When you talk about bonds, like you you know, what are bonds? So I don't know. Like this is maybe just me kind of like, you know, speaking off the cuff here a little bit, but I would just love to see kind of like a 101 from local government in terms of what this looks like and how it applies to you in layman's terms.
Sure. And I can give a quick example, actually. The bonds the city passed are they had to go before the voters, because they're tied to property tax revenue. Mm-hmm. Those will always, as long as the city is bringing in revenue, they will always pay those back. And because they tie the city that thoroughly, locals have to basically say yes or no on them.
Yeah.
These bonds, the limited and special obligation bonds, LOBs and SOBs, those are kind of more the debt you think of as closer to like a mortgage. They're backed by city property. They're backed by, you know, by city assets. And so that's kind of a different – they're a different sort of creature.
Mm-hmm.
And the city doesn't necessarily – notably, the city took a council vote for this. They didn't have to put it before the voters because this sort of debt isn't tied as much to like something that everyone has to pay in that will tie the city in not in perpetuity, but for a very long time to these. I think that's really important to note as well because, this stuff seems – we were talking about iceberg issues before. This stuff seems obscure until like all of a sudden you have some major issue with it and people wonder why wasn't it being paid attention to more. I would also advise listeners to check out a piece called a Quick Guide to City Speak that we did a while back. If you put City Speak in Asheville Blade, it should come up, and it details what a lot of these terms – not sort of the more obscure financial ones, but things like best practices and stakeholders. Yeah. The city staff use a lot. They're really not that comprehensible to the public. What do they actually mean? And what's more, just from my observations as a political reporter, what do they mean in practice versus what they mean on paper?
Exactly. And really quickly to kind of close this conversation regarding the obligation refunding bonds, are there any projects and infrastructure pieces right now that are being talked about refinancing or?
Well, the refinancing covers a whole bunch of the city's debt on this. And interestingly, this is debt to the extent the city can't just go to a bank and be like, hey, loan us the money. Mm-hmm. They have to kind of go on the municipal bond market, which is its own market, and say, look, the Asheville's back in this. We have this good rating. We're back in this through some property we own. Buy it, basically, so we can get this debt financed. Sidewalks. A lot of it was sidewalks, though I think it wasn't up on the screen personally for long enough. Whitehorn did put up this long list of projects this was going for, and not a lot of them were sidewalks. And the city has a major sidewalk problem, so it's not surprising they're trying to find ways to finance that as best they can.
Interesting. Well, moving on, David, to kind of close out this most recent city council meeting, there was public comment, which is always an interesting thing that takes place at the end of these meetings. But specifically, there was comment from a representative from Transmission.
Yes. Bryn Estelle, who's representative from Transmission, and I should note, has written for The Blade multiple times before.
Can you share with the listeners what Transmission, who they are and what they do?
Transmission is a local support and advocacy group for trans individuals.
Thank you.
Bryn has written for us before about a number of trans issues and basically specifically that this city is, not nearly as LGBT, especially trans friendly as it pretends to be.
Yeah.
And, personally, if I can speak as an editor for a minute, I think she's written about that pretty eloquently. Her last piece called Throw Me Out When the Party's Over talks about the way the local political structure, some of it anyway, caved on trans rights when it came to approving HB 142, which is a kind of non-repeal bill that keeps a lot of the infamous HB 2 in place, and how trans voices after that, ones that local legislators had sought to, have back them and support them during the campaign, were totally just shut out to a ridiculous and frankly very bigoted degree.
Mm-hmm.
I think that proved that even among some of our Democratic legislators and you know, local figures that sadly transphobia is alive and well. So the HB-142 issue was back up again because a big controversial thing in this is the city of Asheville's, to be honest, even compared to other cities in the state, relative inaction on this topic. You know, there was a push by Equality NC and the Campaign for Southern Equality and Transmission before HB-2 passed for Asheville to join Charlotte and pass non-discrimination ordinance, kind of make it clear this is a more statewide thing. It did not happen. Asheville refused to do so and basically cited the opinion of our city attorney who has said things like she doesn't believe they, them pronouns, which a lot of trans people, myself included, use, are proper, which is totally false. But we are talking about what is a widely and rightly considered a sign of blatant disrespect and is false. And this is a major city official was saying this back in 2016. So, but without giving a 101 – the city attorney has taken a very conservative legal philosophy on basically the city has almost no ability to combat discrimination. And largely, despite technically saying they're progressive, council has pretty much bought this, like hook, line, and sinker. And that's led to a lot of criticism about you know, missed opportunities. Could council have stood up more? As recently as last year, when the SoCon tournament was going to come here, Campaign for Southern Equality said, look, we'll cover the legal representation. We have a pro bono legal team that would defend the city, saying, look, we're going to straight up defy HB2. We're going to pass on discrimination ordinance, which HB2 at the time did not allow. Yep. And its successor now does not allow either. And just say, look, we're going to go to court. We don't think this law is legitimate.
Yeah.
We have backing on this, and we're going to, you know, stand up for Ashevillians. They didn't do it again. And so Estelle was back to say, look, you know, this is part of a larger attempt to eradicate trans people from public life. It is blatant. It is happening at the federal level and the state level, and we really need our local officials to stand up. She noted the mayor, Mayor Mannheimer, has endorsed HB-142. She used the word applaud for it when it passed, saying it was a good compromise. And HB-142 keeps largely intact. Lambda Legal, rightly, as just as analyzing, I think, called it a fake repeal.
Yep.
She called. She said, look, Asheville needs to really, you know, condemn HB-142 unequivocally, pass on discrimination ordinance array, defend it. There's another speaker, Casey Campfield, who has spoken on some local issues, who also got up and said, look, I agree with this. City needs to take fighting this discrimination very seriously. No response from council, not a one.
No one had anything in response to that public comment?
None.
Well, on that note, I kind of want to transition here briefly. I know this is the city council report, but we are in the thick of things as it pertains to the local election cycle. And for many of you, you are aware that tomorrow, Friday, is the deadline to vote in the
to register to vote. Yeah, you haven't voted yet.
Yeah, please. I'm sorry. Tomorrow is the deadline to register to vote for the October 10th primary election, and then after that, that will be narrowed down to 6 candidates, and then you will then vote for those candidates on November 7th. And also, there is a mayoral race happening with four.
A pretty important one.
Really important mayoral race that's happening. So, the trans issue that continues to come up, that, you know, your opinions, my opinions, the public's opinions in terms of what the city is or isn't doing in regards to speaking out against that. It did get brought up last night at the Democratic Socialist Forum.
Yeah.
And so I just maybe want to just kind of quickly touch on that. Again, this is not specifically what took place at city council, but really what is important, because
it's important.
It's absolutely important. And so, David, I would love to hear maybe some just overall thoughts, reflections on the forum itself, maybe maybe without, you know, specifically kind of noting any individual candidates, but just in terms of the tenor and the feel that you got from that.
It was an interesting indication of how far, I'd say far to the left, that's inaccurate, that Asheville's politics has moved the left as far as what the mainstream political culture is willing to talk about. You know, last night you had the DSA, as might be obvious, asked, do you consider yourself a socialist? And most of the candidates answered yes.
Yes.
So it's funny. One of the first articles I did way, way, way back when as a young reporter for Mountain Express, when I worked there, I was freelancing there actually, was on the use of the socialism word.
Uh-huh.
And used to hear conservative far-right councilmembers like Karl Mumpower, you know, Tarr, anyone who was – people were basically centrist or maybe slightly left of center as, you know, socialist. And almost in that exact tone of voice, you had one neighborhood that – one a bit more forest neighborhood near around there that was going to be, you know, annexed and fought it for a while. And they put out posters saying, you know – we are fighting this. We're fighting the socialists on city council.
Wow.
So it used to be this very much like a slur word.
Wow.
But, you know, you saw a major turnout for Bernie Sanders, who was an avowed socialist.
Yep.
And heck, plenty of socialists would say, you know, Sanders was, you know, not even nearly the most left-leaning or a solidly left-leaning socialist. He'd be sort of New Deal Democrat back in the day. So it was interesting, but it was, you know, you might have had one or two candidates that would have put in a good word for socialism back in the day. And now, like, you saw most candidates saying, yes, I do consider myself a socialist. I do favor these proposals.
This is fascinating.
You had – some hedged a bit, you know, say, oh, well, I'm an independent. But you know, I do favor – I do take a socialist view towards these certain topics. But you know – and granted, these were candidates that the DSA had invited. So, you know, certainly some of the more there are more conservative candidates who would never touch that label in a million years running for council. You know, we have developers and hoteliers running. They're not generally going to be like, I'm a socialist. So with that kind of going on, that was fascinating on a level. And I do think it's a sign that not to keep dropping old blade pieces, but some of these do provide some key context. There's an essay we wrote during the last election called About Asheville's Politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage you to look at that because it kind of spells out some of the divisions that actually did happen. Especially, you know, that Asheville's current government is far left is ludicrous. It's much more of kind of a centrist, even center right on some issues kind of government, center left on some other issues. But, you know, what does progressive in kind of quote marks mean in Asheville? You know, why there are a lot more people who lean the left of city council, well, the left in Asheville, but why haven't they generally got representatives on council?
Mm-hmm.
Why have conservatives used to have a lot of representatives on council but collapsed in the last decade? And so those are interesting questions to look at in the context of this election. It wasn't the issue around HB 142 did come up, actually, and most of the candidates said that they were either definitely, you know, agreed with the course that Estelle and Transmission and previously the Cambridge on the quality as well had kind of advocated. But also, interestingly, the one of the main exceptions who did take it to stand against it was an incumbent councilor, Cesar Bothman. I do feel like this does need to be mentioned. And I will note the Blade does not endorse council members. I do occasionally feel the need to criticize or call a particular action by a councilor, a particular stance. But Bothwell and I have publicly written a column that I think council should oppose this much more heavily than they have. So people take that with a grain of salt as much as they wish. My opinions are pretty clear. But he said that, you know, we have to pick our battles. This was not a battle he was willing to pick, and that he did not think it was worth the hundreds of thousands of dollars that it would take. And that he thought the city would almost certainly lose. I've read more legal white papers than I can count in this issue. That is not at all certain. The record of blatantly discriminatory legislation getting struck down in federal courts. It's hit or miss here and there, but it has happened. As far back as the 90s, you had courts saying, look, you can't blatantly make laws that discriminate against gay people, for example. So there is some precedent here. So I don't know where he was getting that from unless he just is buying a very – not just conservative but very far-right legal philosophy. But I have to say, as a trans person who covers city government, uses city government, I found that appalling. I think it was a – saying that trans people in Asheville are not worth a few hundred thousand dollars in a legal battle is blatantly dismissing our lives and experiences and the very real level of violence and hatred that we're trying to face to go about our lives right now. And from a sitting Asheville city councilor, that statement is disgusting.
Yeah. Well, for the listeners out there who want to be more engaged and want to hear more about what these candidates have to say and what their platforms are, there are other candidate forums coming up. Is that correct, David?
Yeah, there's pretty shortly there's a forum coming up for Asheville on Bikes on the 21st. That's always a very interesting forum. Mm-hmm. A lot of issues, especially around transportation and gentrification infrastructure, tend to get brought up at that forum.
Yeah.
And typically that's one of the more interesting – a very interesting one, partly because, people who don't necessarily have a car And you know, have to rely on transit or walking or cycling to get around, often ask some very pointed questions of city officials. And Absolutely. It's a real issue here.
Absolutely. Well, David, this has been a really lively, interesting conversation, as they always are. And I so appreciate the time that you have, that you give to us, Asheville FM, and your perspectives and insights. And for the listeners out there who want to learn more about some of the journalism and the pieces that you all produce through the Asheville Blade, where can they check that out?
AshevilleBlade.com. As a matter of fact, we sent out questions to city council and mayoral candidates today, and those will be published right around kind of in the middle of early voting, so people kind of have a glimpse at their responses. It should be – we should get some pretty interesting replies.
And it's coming – it's just right around the corner, voting general for municipal election again November 7th, and the primary election is going to be October 10th.
This Friday, register to vote, y'all.
Well, thank you again, David, for joining us.
Always a pleasure.